The challenge of David Livingstone today. Our vision is Africa for Christ. The sword, the word in Africa, that's the symbol of our mission. And we look to David Livingstone as an example of excellence. Dr. David Livingstone's life, legacy, and literature continue to speak to us today. The challenge of David Livingstone is most relevant to our times. If Dr. David Livingstone was here today at Livingstone House, what would he say to us? We do not need to guess. We have his writings. We have his published statements available. We can know exactly what David Livingstone would say to us today. It's what he said to the people of his generation. The salvation of men ought to be the chief desire and aim of every Christian. All men have the right to hear God's word. No nation ought to hoard the gospel like a miser. Can the love of Christ not carry the missionary where the slave trade carries the slave trader? In response to a missionary said, "Do you have a good road to where you are? If so, we have missionaries who'd like to join you." David Livingstone wrote back, "If you have men who will come only if they know there's a good road, I don't want them. I want men who will come even if there's no road at all." We must be uncommon Christians. Now, this is a letter he wrote to his sisters. We must be uncommon Christians. That is, eminently holy and devoted servants of the Most High. Let us seek that selfishness be extirpated, that pride banished, unbelief driven from the mind, every idol dethroned, everything hostile to holiness and opposed to the divine will crucified, that holiness to the Lord may be engraved on the heart and evermore characterize our whole conduct. We have still a debt of gratitude to Jesus, and there's no greater privilege on earth than after having our own chains broken off to go forth and proclaim liberty to the captives, the opening of prison to them that are bound. Dr. David Livingstone was inspired by an optimistic view of the future. Like most of the missionaries of the 19th century, Livingstone held to the eschatology of victory. Discoveries and inventions are cumulative, filling the earth with the glory of the Lord. All nations will sing his glory and bow before him. Our work and its fruits are cumulative. We work towards a new state of things. Future missionaries will be rewarded for conversions for every sermon. We are their pioneers and helpers. Let them not forget the watchmen of the night who worked when all was gloom and no evidence of success in the way of conversions cheers our path. They will doubtless have more light than we, but we serve our master earnestly and we proclaim the same gospel they will do. A quiet audience today, he wrote in his journal. The seed is being sown, the least of all seeds now, but it will grow into a mighty tree. It is as if it were a small stone cut out of a mountain, but it will fill the whole earth. We work for a glorious future, which we are not destined to see, the golden age, which has not yet been, but which will be. We are only morning stars shining in the dark, but the glorious morn will break. The good time is coming yet. The dominion has been given by the power of commerce and population unto the people of the saints of the Most High. This is an everlasting kingdom, a little stone cut out of the mountain without hands, which will cover the whole earth for this time we work. Of course, he's referring to the vision of Daniel, the head of gold, the chest of silver, the stomach of bronze, the legs of iron, the feet of iron and clay, symbolizing all the empires of the world from the Babylonian, the Medo-Persian, the Greek Empire through to the Roman Empire. And the stone struck the statue and it crumbled to dust and the wind blew the dust away and that stone grew to be a mountain that filled the whole earth. Daniel chapter 2. And so he's referring to this, how the kingdom of God will destroy and replace all the kingdoms of this world. By different agencies, the great ruler is bringing all things into a focus. Jesus is gathering all things to himself, and he is daily becoming more and more the center of the world's hopes and of the world's fears. Today, According to Operation World, 2010 edition, there are over 500 million people in Africa who claim to be Christians. Now, bear in mind, there were not even 5 million Christians in all of Africa when David Livingstone landed here in 1841. Now, this 500 million nominal Christians includes 150 million Protestants, 50 million Anglicans, 140 million Charismatics, 60 million Pentecostals, and 100 million Independents, just in Africa. David Livingstone plowed in stony ground and sowed the gospel seed that has produced this great harvest. This could not have been imagined back in the 1840s, you would have thought, but Livingstone foresaw this. All the ends of the earth will remember and turn to the Lord, and all the families of the nation shall worship before you, for the kingdom is the Lord's, and he rules over the nations. The life and the legacy of David Livingstone changed my life. As a new Christian, converted 3rd of April 1977, I imbibed many of the presuppositions and tendencies of the churches of the 1970s. I read The Late Great Planet Earth, and There's a New World Coming, and Satan is Alive and Well on Planet Earth, and other date-setting, end times, rapture fever publications. We were singing I Wish We'd All Been Ready, along with Gary Norman and all the rest of it, watching Like a Thief in the Night and A Distant Thunder. I was saved. I loved the Lord. I was enthusiastically involved in evangelism, but my understanding of biblical doctrine was actually quite shallow. I imbibed the prevailing prejudice against Calvinism, and I was convinced that we were living in the last days, in fact, the last hours, really. I could not, therefore, at that time, even consider marriage or children. There wasn't enough time, or Bible college, for that matter. I could not allow myself to be distracted by such worldly matters as family and raising children. I needed to devote the last few days on earth to snatching a few souls from the fire before the great rapture snatch took us all up. The rapture was coming before the end of 1977, 78, 79, 80, 81, 82. The plants are lining up in 1982. Seriously, we were absolutely obsessed with it. There's a lot of us who were really caught up in it. I was completely closed out of theological training. What's the point? The Lord will have come before I could have even finished the first year. Forget about graduated. Better to stay in the field winning souls in his last few days remaining. Then I read The Puritan Hope, Revival and the Interpretation of Prophecy by Ian Murray, published by Band of Truth, who published a lot of great books. Band of Truth is really great. This book informed me that all of the pioneer missionaries of the 19th century missionary movement were Calvinist and post-millennial. Well, I had no idea what post-millennialism was, but from what I read, that the father of modern missions, William Carey, and the best friend Africa ever had, David Livingstone, that they were both Reformed and post-millennial, I determined I had to read up on these matters. Now, earlier I'd read some thin modern biography on David Livingstone, which didn't seem too extraordinary because, like most modern books, it had been sanitized. All controversial, politically incorrect details had been omitted. The modern censored versions of David Livingstone's life didn't seem that impressive because they didn't mention the ravages of the Islamic slave trade he confronted and documented and fought against. It left out his Calvinist convictions and his post-millennial eschatology victory. I mean, why confuse modern readers with facts like that? Just snip, 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 edit it all out, delete. The modern biographies left out the fact that David Livingstone carried a six-barreled revolver and a double-barreled rifle. Pretty advanced from 1840. His violent confrontations with Islamic slave traders, his bold initiatives to set thousands of captives free, were also apparently deemed too controversial to include in these modern, sanitized, abridged versions of Livingstone's life. I mean, why confuse people with facts? However, I'd always been a bookworm and had a love for history. So finding most of the books available in the average bookshop today to be shallow and predictable, I've developed a preference for scouring through second-hand bookshops, finding rare old first editions of the missionaries and the pioneers. I was reading Livingstone's missionary travels as I was following in much of his footsteps in Tet province of Mozambique in the Zambezi Valley in 1989. And that was when I and the American medical team I was leading were captured by Russian forces, imprisoned in SNASP security prison in Mashava, Maputo. What I learned from the writings and from the exemplary life of the extraordinary legacy of David Livingstone transformed my life and my ministry. So, What did I learn from David Livingstone? I learned from David Livingstone the importance of discipline. He was disciplined in reading. He was disciplined in exercise. He was self-controlled. Livingstone abstained from alcohol for life. He was temperate. He was duty-oriented. He was hard-working. Livingstone's work ethic is a rebuke to all of us. From age 10, he worked 14 hours a day, 6 days a week, walking an average of 34 kilometers a day, much of this in a crawling or stooping position amongst or under the machinery or bouncing over it. Imagine the tremendous physical training this was for his later transcontinental expeditions on foot throughout Africa. This he did in esteemed heat and humidity considered essential for the production of thread. David used his first week's wages to purchase a book on Latin. I mean, what did you spend your first wage on? I know I was 17 when I got my first wages. I had matriculated, and my first month was working on the ICL 2980 computer at Old Mutual. And after midnight shift for a month, I got my first salary, and I went out and I bought a suit, 17 rand for a nice suit, a belt, and shoes. All of that came to under 20 rand. And then I bought an umbrella and a black briefcase, black umbrella, black briefcase. So that was my priorities at age 17, getting my first wages. Livingstone, at age 10, his first wages he used to buy a book on Latin, Rudiments of Latin. Now, less than 10% of the children who worked in the cotton mills ever learned to read or write. David Livingstone not only learned to read and write, he taught himself Latin and Greek and Hebrew. And each night after work, he had attended night school from 8 p.m. to 10 p.m. What are you doing between 8 and 10 p.m.? Then at home, he'd study, often until midnight. Each morning began at 5:30 when the bell rang, because everyone in a tenement worked for the cotton mill and had to be at work by 6 a.m. And before I leave this picture, his mother kept him out of school until he was 10, which was older than most. Many would start working in the cotton mill at age 6. And so he got in a lot more reading beforehand. Well, at age 9, he is lying on the banks of the Clyde River, and he is reading, and suddenly a scream awakened him from his book that he is buried into, and he saw that a little girl was having an adventure with her baby brother, and they were in a boat, and she had lost the oars. The oars were floating away, and this boat was being sucked into the paddle wheel of the mill. And this massive paddle wheel would crush the boat and doubtless kill these two children in minutes. Without hesitation, he plunged into the icy river. He rescued the girl and her baby brother, took them home, and never said a word about it. Never said a word about it. In all the books he wrote, never mentioned it. The only reason we even know about this is because somebody discovered the application forms and testimonials for David Livingstone, which is in the attic of the London Missionary Society. And amongst it was a letter giving this testimony, because his father and others had been asked to give a testimonial of him, and this incident happened to be mentioned. And the only reason his parents knew about it is because the parents of the little girl and her brother came and thanked them for this, what their little son had done. But I mean, David Livingstone, he did this and never even mentioned it. When he was studying medicine and theology, he would walk from Blantyre to Glasgow, refusing every offer of a ride on a horse carts passing by. He preferred the four-hour walk, often in snow, in order to strengthen his muscles for his chosen career in missions. He had spent 12 years in the cotton mills, saving up to put himself through university, and doing all this hard work physically, so he was physically tough. He wasn't going to let his study time now make his muscles rot. Livingstone never accepted charity. Although being brought up in the poorest of circumstances, where his family of seven were forced to live in a single room, this room, 10 feet by 14 feet, without any electricity, without any plumbing, without any running water. That's seven lived in this room. The parents' bed was there. Other mattresses were kept underneath. They'd pull out the mattresses. And so that picture he showed earlier of him sitting at a table and his mother opening door, you know, why he slept. Actually, that's imaginative, because they only had one room. This was the room. Everything. Sewing, cooking, the whole lot done in this room. He worked and he saved to put himself through both medical school and theological college. David was the first worker from the cotton mills to receive a university education, and nobody gave it to him. I've read in some of these ignorant biographies that are out in the market these days that David Livingston received a bursary to study at college. There were no bursaries in the 1830s. Which planet are these people orbiting? And there's this mentality today that, well, you can't possibly study unless somebody gives you freebies to do it. Well, David Livingston saved and put himself through theological seminary and through medical college, through Institute of Surgeons. Interesting. He wouldn't have accepted charity even if it had been offered. He earned it. He passed it with high honors. He received his doctorate from the Royal Faculty of Physicians and Surgeons, November 1840. He was ordained as a congregational minister, 20th of November, 1840. Against all odds, he achieved far more than any would have thought humanly possible for someone born into such a poverty-stricken and disadvantaged background. Now, this is what the tenement looked like where he was brought up in. Now, I've heard people say, I've seen books, picture of David Livingston's house. No, 24 families lived in this tenement, and each family had one room. And there was one water pump. There's the water pump. Every drop of water for washing, cooking, cleaning, drinking had to be carried by buckets up those circular stairs. And they were on the top floor. And so David and his brother walked up many times every day carrying enough water for the family. He didn't wait for someone else to open up Africa. He didn't wait for someone to invent the four-wheel drive vehicle. He didn't wait for someone to build the bridges and the roads. He drew the first maps of the Zambezi River, this being one of them, for example. He did not have an attitude of entitlement. David Livingston had a Protestant work ethic, a very serious Protestant work ethic. The maps of Africa before the times of Livingston are embarrassing and humorous. They didn't have a clue. And the maps of Africa were pretty pathetic, literally. This is now the 1600s. People are producing dumb maps like this. Even here, when you see the Nile River goes to roughly the Transvaal, which is why when you go to the Kruger National Park today, you will see on the guidance maps there, Nile crocodile. Now, it's not because these crocodiles come from Egypt. The Nile crocodile in Limpopo or in Kruger Park are just South African crocodiles, but because they assumed, this must be the mountains of the moon, this must be the Nile crocodile, because everyone thought this is where it came from. That's what the map said. This is the 16th century map. The mountains of the moon and the Nile comes all the way down to, well, here, probably somewhere around Zimbabwe. And 1529, they've still got this. One Nile coming down, ending roughly around Zimbabwe and perhaps Tet province of Mozambique. Even when David Livingston arrived here, this is what the maps looked like. Mostly empty, blank, unexplored territory, no idea. In fact, before the time of Livingston, all the geographers assumed that the interior of Africa was one big desert. Yeah, Sahara Desert, Namib Desert, it's all desert. And it's David Livingston who filled in the blanks and to let people know, no, Africa's not one big desert in the interior. There's, in fact, lots of major rivers and plateaus, valleys, savannas, all kinds of amazing things, and massive inland lakes. He filled in the empty maps. And he, without the benefits that we've got of GPSs and satellites, he drew the first map of the Zambezi. And today, when you compare it to a satellite map, it's accurate. He did this on the ground. How did he do that? Well, first of all, he was using the sextant to work out latitudes and longitudes, and he was using his thermometer, testing every time he boiled water for tea, at what temperature it boiled, noting it down, and worked out the exact upper and lower, what the altitudes were. And at one time, 1955, it's easy for me to remember my wife's birthday because it's on the same date that David Livingston discovered Victoria Falls, 16th of November. 16th of November, 1855, he saw this massive cloud of smoke. Asked the local people, what is that? Musi Oyatanya, the smoke that thunders. What makes the smoke thunder? Spirits. Have you been there? Are you out of your mind? No, place is haunted. You're kidding, nobody goes there. And so David Livingstone hired a boat and went down towards the Foster and Foster Going River, and he stopped on that island that today we call Livingstone Island. Good thing he did stop. It would have been a long way down. Now, this picture is a bit imaginative. It's got these people happily standing with tall spears. There was no one else with them. You've got to be. This just shows the kind of idiocy of the people back home who didn't even understand what had happened as they tried to picture what he did. But he did crawl to the end, and he looked out at a scene so amazing. He said, angels at creation must have stopped and gazed in wonder at such scenes. And he called it the most incredible sight that he'd ever seen in his life. And it's even today recognized one of the seven natural wonders of the world. This is Livingstone Island. He stopped his canoe there just as well, crawled to the edge, looked out over it, and that's today called Livingstone Island. That's exactly where he let down from this edge rope with weight on it. He was ready. 310 feet deep. No jokes. There's another perspective of Livingstone Island. I don't know if you'd want to crawl to the edge of that. Looking from this perspective, because now we can go around with helicopters and microlights, and I've flown over the falls in a Cessna, I don't know how many people would want to crawl to the edge of that. And that gives you another perspective. But he let it down, and this is his sketch, which you get in first edition of Livingstone's Travels. So you see at the bottom, Victoria Falls, 1,860 yards wide. That's correct. That's what it is. We haven't been able to improve on that statistic. How did he work that out? You can't exactly pace out a waterfall. And then 310 feet deep. That's what it is, 310 feet deep. And he paced out 400 yards from the first cataract to the first gorge and 150 paces from this gorge to that gorge. And he puts in a different detail. So this was his first sketch map. He did further than that, also from the Livingstone's first edition, which we've got here. He did this sketch, which is extraordinary because there is no elevation from which you can get this perspective. But instead of just sketching what he saw, which would already be quite a feat, he sketched from an imagined height to give people a bit of depth perception. Which, how did he do it? There was no such place. It's hard enough to do a painting when you can see what you are painting. And he did more than this. Because this is what Victoria Falls looks like. But he did this sketch too. There is no elevation where you can see this. Unless today you go by helicopter or something. But this is accurately what the gorges are from Victoria Falls. And again, this is Livingstone's Travels, the first edition sketches provided. And it's accurate. That's what it is. And how on earth, on the ground, could you do that? So this is a phenomenally gifted person. Well, on his second missionary journey, he was given the dream team, they called it. Queen Victoria gave him the best of the best, which included Thomas Baines. You'll see we've got some prints of Thomas Baines' original artwork that are here. Thomas Baines went on this journey to, amongst other things, commissioned by Queen Victoria to do paintings of Victoria Falls. And what you see here is quite extraordinary because what is this showing you? The greatest concentration of wildlife David Livingstone saw anywhere in Africa. And even years later when he came with Thomas Baines, there was still this colossal, it was a wildlife sanctuary because people didn't go there, so the animals were safe from being hunted. And so there was this massive concentration of wildlife in this paradise-like area of great vegetation where there was almost constant moisture all year round. And already you can see quite a lot there. This is from the Rhodesian side, now the Zimbabwe side, view of Main Falls, as they call it. This is what's called Main Falls. And there's always a rainbow at Victoria Falls. Now this is looking at Devil's Cataract. I remember when I first went to Victoria Falls in 1972, being told that an American film crew had just gone over there, gone down Devil's Cataract. They were filming near the falls with the director, the chief cameraman, a whole lot of things, and they got too close and they sucked in, the whole lot went straight down, all 310 feet down, and of course, gone, dead, finished. That film never got made. And these sort of things happen. Even when you go up to Victoria Falls now and you say, do people ever fall over? And locals say, all the time. You know, there's no barriers and fence. You couldn't imagine this at Niagara Falls in America, for example, something like that. But this is Maine Falls, right here. And there's millions of tons of water are passing over every minute. When it's in full flood, it's absolutely staggering. It's so deafeningly loud. And you get saturated. I remember one time Calvin and I went there, there'd been particularly good rainfall. If we had jumped in the Zambezi, we couldn't have got wetter. Socks, clothes, everything just saturated. Just from standing there, just because of the moisture, it's so, so thunderous. It's hard to even hear a person talking close to your ears. And it's one of the most amazing, magnificent, incredible, awe-inspiring things that you can see. Well, on the 16th of November, 1955, on the centenary of David Livingstone discovering Victoria Falls, they unveiled the classic monument to David Livingstone at Victoria Falls in what then would have been Southern Rhodesia. And it's a very excellent portrayal of David Livingstone. And you notice his Bible in his left hand there, and very much his kind of whole demeanor. To achieve what David Livingstone did, Livingstone was decisive, goal-orientated, and inflexible. Reformed theology put doctrinal steel in his backbone. He was a man of integrity. He was a man of his word. He meant what he said, and he said what he meant. He walked many thousands of miles across difficult and dangerous terrain to return his porters to the village. Now, after his first missionary journey, well, he would have thought it was his first missionary journey, he had just taken his family back to Cape Town, put them on boats, sent them over to Britain where they could be with family, because he had been criticized because all of his family, every one of his children and his wife, had come down with fever on a missionary tour in what today is Botswana. And he is heavily criticized, including by his parents-in-law, for being so irresponsible. So he sent them back to Britain as he began his first major missionary journey on his own. He is criticized for leaving his family. So, you know, you're kind of damned if you do, damned if you don't. On a second missionary journey, when his wife joined him, and she died in what today is Mozambique and the Zambezi Valley, he was criticized for taking his wife with him. So he's criticized for taking his family in the field, criticized when he didn't take them in the field, and he's criticized when his wife came in the field and, of course, died in the field as well. And her grave is in Mozambique to this day. But when he had crossed South Africa, Botswana, Zimbabwe, Zambia, and Angola, and he got to the Rwandan port, there was a British ship, the Forerunner, waiting for him. He had already accomplished something no one had ever done, and it was an amazing accomplishment, and he would have been welcomed back to Britain, to hear his welcome. But he took another 2 years to go back because he didn't want to leave his porters in Portuguese territory, where the Portuguese were the only European nation still engaging in slavery. And out of fear for that, plus he is concerned to help his porters get back through many hostile tribes. So instead of leaving them to find their own way back, he took them back across the continent that almost killed him the first time. That's the kind of person of integrity he was. He went 2 years out of his way to help these people. David Livingstone understood the power of prayer. He had Holy Spirit fire in his heart, soul, and mind. He prayed and sang the Psalms daily. He loved the Psalms. He had a great love for God's creation, for nature, and for wildlife. His books are filled with intricate sketches and fascinating details of animals and vegetation, like of the eland, the largest buck or antelope in Africa, and the hippopotamus, of which not much was known at that stage, and the waterbuck, and of the baobab tree, and the things you can do with the baobab tree, including making rope and sandals and so many good things that you can get out of the baobab tree. He documents the different types of tools that the people were using, like the double-handed and Golaho and the different types of body piercing and tattoo marks that people made and the bangles they wore around the ankles and the different types of facial markings that people have, the different tools, the different hairstyles, the strange attires that people would have, including the musical instruments. And these are all sketches in Livingstone's first edition. The different rituals, the new moon rituals that people would go through, and how the bushmen would be collecting water from the rivers in ostrich eggs and putting, holding off ostrich eggs, putting in tufts of grass, and then carrying them in nets and then burying them at different places that they had water to go to when they're crossing deserts, and all sorts of interesting, fascinating observations of God's creation. Livingstone saw Africa when there were massive, colossal herds, bigger than anything we would see today in our game reserves. And to think he walked across Africa for 26 years, one side to the other, and met a whole lot of very dangerous creatures, and he managed to survive, which is absolutely extraordinary. Just think of these, the fastest animals in the world, the tallest animals in the world, the strongest animals in the world, the most powerful. And he also reported there's snow at the equator, which, of course, was totally discounted because, along with other missionaries, people thought, don't be ridiculous. There's no way there can be snow at the equator in Africa. Everyone knows that's not possible. Well, until photography, people didn't believe the missionaries, and now it's been proven that they were quite right. There is snow at the equator, Kilimanjaro, Mount Kenya, but these are the sort of things people sort of, how can anyone believe that? And David Livingstone was inspired by post-millennial eschatology of victory. He had a kingdom vision. David Livingstone understood the greatness of the Great Commission. He worked to comprehensively fulfill the Great Commission by ministering to body, mind, and spirit. As a medical doctor, he ministered to the body. He healed bodies all over Africa. As a teacher, he ministered to the mind. And as a preacher of the gospel, he ministered to the spirit. This, by the way, is a stained glass window in Livingstonia, in Malawi. David Livingstone sowing the seed of the Word of God. Wherever he went, he used his medical knowledge and his training, his breadth of reading and his learning, and his deep faith and knowledge of the Holy Scriptures to enrich and empower the people of Africa. And on the flyleaf of his book is the tsetse fly. As he said, the tsetse fly kills far more people in Africa than the lions do. And some people might have thought he'd put a lion on there, but he said, in fact, he considered the mosquito, because the mosquito kills far more people than any other. In fact, the mosquito is one of the most deadly. But the tsetse fly prevents vast amounts of parts of Africa being reached by people on horseback. If you've ever seen artwork of David Livingstone riding a horse in Africa, you know it's fictional. Nobody could take a horse in those areas. The tsetse fly would kill the horses. Yes. And the cattle, too. I remember one of our people getting stung by a tsetse fly in a game reserve bush training in Rhodesia, and sort of cursing tsetse fly, and the game ranger who was training us said, praise God for the tsetse fly. Without the tsetse fly, you wouldn't have game reserves. The game reserves of the world, the great game reserves you can think of, like Wanky Game Reserve, these are places where the tsetse fly makes cattle farming impossible and makes human habitation generally impossible. And so the tsetse fly has actually kept vast parts of Africa free for nature reserves and game sanctuaries. And so don't despise even the tsetse fly. He's got his job too. And so tsetse fly is here on the flyleaf of Livingstone's travels. Now, do you know that David Livingstone was the first scientist to identify mosquitoes as the cause of malaria? And he was decades ahead of the scientific and medical community, because the scientists and the medical specialists all looked down on David Livingstone. How could a tsetse fly, how could a mosquito have anything to do with malaria? I mean, look at the name, the very etymology of the word malaria. Malaria, bad air. Malaria is swamp fever. It's caused by bad air. Solution? High ceilings. Let the bad air rise. And so David Livingstone is now suggesting an insect is causing malaria. I mean, how unscientific is that? Well, David Livingstone went further. He said, you can get bitten by a mosquito at different times of day, but you can only get malaria if you're bitten by the pregnant female mosquito between the hours of about 11 o'clock at night and 5 in the morning. And again, people are like, How on earth can you even tell the difference between a male and a female mosquito or a pregnant one? But David Livingston was that observant, and he's been proven right. He is right. And we've even seen it in our mission. If you stay under your mosquito net between 11 at night and 5 in the morning, you will not get malaria. You might get mosquito bites, but you won't get malaria. And Livingston not only identified the mosquito as the cause of malaria, but he actually diagnosed the cure. And I remember in Rhodesia getting these, Livingston's Rouser, quinine and rhubarb compound, and this was to be taken in the event of someone coming down with malaria. And Livingston's Rouser, the quinine, comes from an extraordinary coincidence in his life. As he was coming out to Africa in 1840 to 1841, his ship split a foremast in the Atlantic and put in to Rio de Janeiro and had to hunt around the Amazon to find a decent tall tree to turn to a new foremast for the ship. And while they were doing it, Livingston was doing his going through the bushes and taking clippings of different trees and documenting down and all kinds of interesting rocks. And later in Africa, he planted some of the seeds of the quinine tree, and he found that the quinine bush was the perfect antidote to malaria. And he tried all kinds, you can imagine, this wasn't just a lucky guess. He was always testing it, and he used himself like a guinea pig for many of his medicines. And you can see in Livingston's travels details on observing his symptoms while the lion was biting him in the shoulder and ripping him around. He's saying, this is very interesting because he didn't feel any pain. This must be, he is shaken by the lion like a dog shakes a rat. And he said, but I felt no pain at the time. Now, this must be a gift from the Creator that you go into shock during a time of trauma like this and you don't feel any pain. And he's putting down his symptoms of things, and he'd even go to the witch doctor and say, well, what would you give for this? And then he'd put down, analyze what was in this compound he gave, and then noted that actually it made no difference at all. It didn't help the fever. Then he tried different other things. So a scientific mind. And that's how he stayed in the field 26 years, when the average life expectancy of a missionary to West Africa was 2 years. He died of fever. And he had fever many times, but he recovered because he had quinine. David Livingston teaches us that actions speak louder than words. He was described as a man of resolute courage. Fire, water, stone wall would not stop Livingston the fulfillment of any recognized duty. Indeed, he didn't let swamps stop him, he didn't let rivers stop him, he didn't let deserts or mountains prevent him from opening up Africa for the gospel. David Livingston was determined to make a difference. The Great Commission was his supreme ambition. Christ's last command was his first concern. He wrote, I hope to be permitted to work as long as I live beyond other men's line of things, and to plant the seed of the gospel where others have not planted. I'm a missionary, heart and soul. God had an only son, and he was a missionary and a physician. A poor, poor imitation of him I am, or wish to be. In his service I hope to live, in it I wish to die. I shall open up a path to the interior, or I shall perish. May God bless us and make us blessings even unto death. Shame upon us missionaries if we are to be outdone by slave traders. If the slave traders can get there, missionaries can get there. Battling rains and chronic discomfort and rust and mildew and rot. Everything canvas rotted, everything metal rusted. Totally drenched, fatigued, laid low by fever on countless occasions. Livingston persevered across the continent. Trials tested the tenacity of the travel-weary team. Livingston often endured unnecessary and excessive suffering and deprivation, hacking his way through dense jungle on foot because lack of funds prevented him from affording the luxury of a canoe. I wouldn't have thought a canoe was a luxury when you're mapping the Zambezi River. These privations, I beg you to observe, are not sacrifices. I think that word ought never to be mentioned in reference to anything we can do for him who, though he was rich, yet for our sakes he became poor. The challenge of David Livingston rings out to us today. Can that be called a sacrifice, which is simply paid back as a small part of a great debt owing to our God, which we can never repay? It is emphatically no sacrifice. Say rather it is a privilege. David Livingstone emphasized that sacrificial service is more powerful than eloquent sermons. We need to put feet to our faith. It's not so much what we say, but what we do. Livingstone also alerted the world to the cancerous sore of the Islamic slave trade. It was missionary explorer David Livingstone whose graphic descriptions brought the ravages of the East African slave trade to light. Quote from his missionary travels, a narrative of an expedition to the Zambezi, which exposed the horrors of the Islamic slave trade. Two of the women had been shot the day before for attempting to untie their tongs. One woman had her infant's brains knocked out because she could not carry her load and the baby. A man was dispatched with an axe because he had broken down with fatigue. Those taken out of the country are but a very small section of the sufferers. We never realized the atrocious nature of the slave traffic until we saw it at its fountainhead. There, truly, Satan has his seat. Besides, actually captured thousands are killed and die of their wounds and famine, driven from the village by internecine war, waged for slaves with their own clansmen and neighbors, slain by the lust of gain, which is stimulated, be it remembered always, by the slave purchasers of Cuba and elsewhere. David Livingstone taught you cannot be neutral in the battles of life. He had the courage to confront evil. His fearless faith fought the good fight of faith, and he set many thousands of captives free. Submit to God, resist the devil, he will flee from you. David Livingstone is an example of extraordinary patience and perseverance. He overcame every obstacle. He walked across the continent of Africa. He walked from Delgoa Bay, what today is Port Elizabeth, all the way up through Graaffreinet, where he was a guest of the Andrew Murray family in Graaffreinet, saying the prettiest town in Africa, most delightful family, in what up to Kuruman in what today is the Northern Cape. He walked across what today is Botswana, all the way back across the Cape Colony to Cape Town, to place his family on a ship to return to Britain. He then walked from Cape Town across the whole of the Cape Province through what is today Botswana, Zambia, Angola, to the port of Luanda. He walked from the Atlantic Ocean across the continent of Africa, across what today is Angola, Zambia, Zimbabwe, and Mozambique, to the Indian Ocean. And he produced this ideal cross-section across South Central Africa from his painstaking daily maps made, which for the first time enable people to understand what is in the hinterland of Africa. I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. He came back on a second missionary journey and explored much of the Zambezi River, the Shiri River, and the Rovuma River. He walked across what is Mozambique and Malawi and Tanzania and Zimbabwe. We are more than conquerors through Christ Jesus who loved us. On his third great missionary journey, he walked across the whole length of Tanzania, much of Mozambique, Malawi, and Zambia, the Congo, Burundi, and he finally died on his knees in prayer in the province of Luapula in northern Zambia. In his 30 years of dedicated missionary service in Africa, he walked from coast to coast across what are today 12 vast countries. He walked across a continent that did not yet have roads or bridges or purified water. He wrote, I will try to hold myself in readiness to go anywhere, provided it be forwards. David Livingstone teaches us the power of the printed word, and we have several of his first edition books here. In fact, we've got first editions of all his books here. It was books that he read, like Practical Christianity by William Wilberforce, which channeled much of his life and dedicated labors to eradicate the slave trade and open up Africa to the gospel. By the way, he read Practical Christianity when he was 12 years old. Livingstone wrote Missionary Travels, the Zambezi Expedition, and his journals, which inspired generations of missionaries to dedicate their lives to winning Africa for Christ. Livingstone's steadfast example inspired Mary Slessor to devote her life to Calabar, present-day Nigeria, where she ended with the killing of twins and slavery. Mary Slessor was actually even poorer than David Livingstone. You know, David Livingstone was poor, but he had parents who loved him. Mary Slessor didn't even have that. She also worked in the cotton mills. She had a mother who loved her, but her father was an abusive drunk. And she ended up having to work for the family to sustain the family from the age 12. By the way, Mary Slessor was no wimp. In one of her prayer letters, she requested Maxim machine guns to deal with the slave traders. Peter Cameron launched African Land Mission as a result of David Livingstone's inspiration. Peter Cameron had returned from African failure after his first mission. However, when he stood in Westminster Abbey and he looked at the tomb of David Livingstone and he read, "Other sheep have I, which are not of this sheepfold. Them also I must bring, and they shall hear my voice." Cameron felt rebuked, inspired, and he resolved to return to Africa, and he started one of the greatest missions in African history, African Land Mission, out of which has grown the African Land Church, one of the largest churches you'll find in East Africa. And by the way, when you have royal weddings in Westminster Abbey, I don't know if you've noticed, there's a slot there which the red carpet goes around. Isn't that interesting? Well, that just happens to be where David Livingstone's tomb is. He got the premier spot in Westminster Abbey. Livingstone knew the power of the printed page and of public speaking tours. He also focused on the universities as strategic for mobilizing reformers and missionaries to fulfill the Great Commission. David Livingstone did not see the rivers as obstacles, as most other people did. He saw them as God's highway to reach Africa for Christ, because all communities need access to water, so rivers are a strategic artery which missionaries should utilize to fulfill the Great Commission. Hence, on a second great missionary journey, he came with a boat, a paddle steamer, which is called the Mar Robert, to go up the Zambezi. David Livingstone believed in leadership training. In fact, his vision was to establish Bible colleges for Africans to be trained as evangelists, teachers, missionaries to disciple the nations. But he was overruled by the leaders in the London Missionary Society. And while it seems sad that they didn't see this vision, but providentially God had another plan for David Livingstone. The life and legacy of David Livingstone has taught me the importance of discipline, exercise, reading, a Christian work ethic, temperance, self-control, self-denial, and to be duty-orientated. His reformed theology has put doctrinal steel in my backbone, and many other people's too. He has taught us the importance of reading and of being a man of my word, a person of integrity, and most important, a student of God's word. The post-millennial eschatology of victory of David Livingstone has encouraged me. We are not working at uncertainty. The Lord who gave us the Great Commission will infallibly ensure that it is fulfilled. His promises and his power are fully sufficient to empower the church to fulfill the Great Commission, making disciples of all nations, teaching obedience to all things that he has commanded. David Livingstone's comprehensive vision of fulfilling the Great Commission, ministering to body, mind, and spirit, has raised the standard of missionary service for all of us. It is a rebuke to religious tourism. Actions speak louder than words. Sacrificial service is more powerful than eloquent sermons. We must put feet to our faith. We must recognize that we are in a world war of worldviews. Speaking of which, I don't know how many people have noticed that I've got a model of a diamond. It's not a real diamond, before anyone tries to break the glass. It's a model of the Cullinan diamond in there next to the Livingstone memorabilia in front of the Livingstone's travels. Because David Livingstone knew geology well. Very well. And he found diamonds all over the Northern Cape. Because here's at Kuruman, not far from Kimberley. He picked up the diamonds and he threw them in a bush and said nothing about them for over 20 years. Well, you remember the most famous journalist of all times, Henry Morton Stanley, when he met with David Livingstone, there they were, the only two white men, all of equatorial Africa, from the Zambezi to the Nile. Stanley walks towards him and says, "Dr. Livingstone, I presume." And David Livingstone responds, "Yes." Lifted his cap slightly, and then they shook hands. "I thank God, doctor, that I've been permitted to see you." Livingstone replies, "I feel thankful that I'm here to welcome you." Stanley then offered Livingstone a packet of letters from his family and friends at home, expecting him to read them immediately. But Livingstone put them to one side and said, "I've been taught patience. I can wait a few more hours longer. Now tell me, what's the general news? How's the world getting on?" Well, he's asking a journalist. So Stanley gave him an update on the opening of the Suez Canal. General Grant's now president of the United States. The Pacific Railroad across the continent of America has been completed. Prussia has defeated Denmark and France. France is meant to be the world superpower militarily. and they've been beaten by Prussia. Who's Prussia? Where are they from? The first transatlantic cable has been laid, permitting immediate communication between North America and Europe. Diamonds have been discovered in South Africa. I wondered how long that would take, Livingston said. And so the story came out to Henry Morton Stanley. You knew of the diamonds there 25 years before they discovered them at Kimberley? Yes. Why didn't you send it? He said, we were busy evangelizing the Tswana people. We couldn't allow them to suddenly be invaded by all these miners and all the drunkenness and worldliness this would bring. It would have destroyed the ministry of discipling the Tswana people. And so Henry Morton Stanley says, couldn't you have just taken some of the diamonds and sold them back at home? He said, wouldn't have worked. These were such valuable diamonds, better than the world had ever seen before. They knew where I came from. They would have torn the place apart to find them. We wouldn't have been able to continue with our missionary work for the last few decades if diamonds had been discovered in the 1840s in what is today Kimberley area. And so just an incredible insight that David Livingstone had found the pearl of great price. He wasn't going to get sidetracked and derailed from his missionary calling just by diamonds. Other people might go insane over diamonds, but he picked them up, threw them in a bush, and said nothing about it. How's that for single-minded devotion and refusing to get sidetracked and derailed? How many other people would have done that? Islam is a threat to faith and freedom. You cannot be neutral. Confront evil. Fight the good fight of faith. Be bold. Be brave. Be courageous. Be patient and steadfast. Persevere. Overcome every obstacle. Obstacles are only there to be overcome. Go forward in the faith. Never forget the power of the printed page. Invest in books. Invest in your mind. Read. Teach your people to love reading. Readers make leaders. A reading Christian is a growing Christian. Do not forget the schools, the colleges, and the universities. They are strategic. We must disciple the next generation to be faithful to God's word and effective in God's service. Think strategically as to how can we reach the nations for Christ. Make your life count for eternity. In the words of C.T. Studd, the great cricketer for Christ, you only have one life and it'll soon be passed. Only what's done for Jesus Christ will last. As William Carey declared, expect great things from God. Attempt great things for God. Honor God with great faith. So what would David Livingstone say to us today? I beg to direct your attention to Africa. I know that in a few years I shall be cut off from that country, which is now open. Do not let it be shut again. I go back to Africa to try to make an open path for commerce and Christianity. Will you carry out the work which I have begun? I leave it with you. Also I heard the voice of the Lord saying, whom shall I send and who will go for us? And answered, here am I, Lord, send me. So, any questions, any comments on Livingstone, his life, his legacy, his literature? Yes?
Is he the one that said, everyone loves peace, but he loves peace enough to fight for it?
That's correct. When he is criticized for shooting at the Arab slave traders in Malawi, and he is criticized, he said, I love peace as much as any man, but I go far beyond you in it because I'm willing to fight for it. In fact, the Bible does say, blessed are the peacemakers, not the pacifists. It takes effort to make peace. So we set up a Livingstone Fellowship website and a Livingstone 200 website, and we've put links and picture galleries. And back in 2013, on the 200th anniversary of David Livingstone's birth, I organized a year-long emphasis on Livingstone's legacy, and we even sent a mission all over Africa in the 12 countries where he had gone. We cheated. We drove. And we ended up at Victoria Falls on the anniversary of when he had discovered Victoria Falls and mapped and named it and made it known to the world. And we had a Livingstone 200 conference up there. We've got a David Livingstone Facebook page as well. And, of course, this mission house is called Livingstone House for good reason. There's some magnificent monuments to him, of course, in Scotland, as you'd expect. He's Scotland's greatest son in many ways. I don't like this monument at his birthplace because it's such bad PR for the Lions. It doesn't have his rifle in his hand. It doesn't have the rifle on the floor. It makes it look like this lion just attacked him for no reason. Actually, as David Livingstone said, it was the dumbest thing he ever did. He got talked by the chief into shooting the lion because the chief gave him a highly unlikely story that the lion was going for their goats. Considering the plethora of zebra and other antelope around the time, why would a lion go for something like a goat when he's got all the zebra and so on? More likely is the chief wanted a lion skin and he saw Livingstone's gun as a chance to get it. So Livingstone shot this lion. I mean, lion was lying on the rock doing nothing, minding his own business. Livingstone shot the lion. The lion got up with a bullet in him, ran to him and broke his shoulder, ripped him apart and then dropped dead on top of him. But the point is, Livingstone drew first blood. And as Livingstone noted, the rest of his life, 26 years he walked across Africa, he was never attacked by a lion ever again. You leave lions alone, they leave you alone. And so this gives the wrong impression. It gives the impression lions are just out there wanting to attack people. So I think this is very unfair of the people to have put this there. He doesn't even have a rifle on the ground or in his hand, which just completely and utterly gives the wrong impression. So on this occasion, I'm on the lion side. But what a dramatic monument still. There's a monument in Ujiji in Tanzania where Henry Morton Stanley and David Livingstone met on the 10th of November 1871. Zambia produced postage stamps in commemoration of the 100th anniversary of the death of David Livingstone, showing him chasing the Arabs out of Zambia. Zambia also has this monument commemorating where David Livingstone died, at Chitambo's village. The tree under which he died has long since perished, and so they've put this monument over where his heart was buried under the tree. As they said, his body must go back to his people to bury in his own land because he's an important person, but his heart belongs in Africa, and so they buried his heart under this tree. This monument occupies the spot where formerly stood the tree at the foot of which Livingstone's heart was buried by his faithful native followers. On the trunk was carved the following inscription, Dr. Livingstone, May the 4th, 1873, Chuma, Suza. Now, he actually died on the 1st of May. They discovered later from his journal the followers made a miscalculation putting the 4th of May, but, I mean, that's minor. Some of the wood of that tree under which Livingstone is buried is in the cathedral on Zanzibar, and it's the cross over the high altar. These are some of Livingstone's books that we've got at our mission, including Livingstone's Zambezi Expedition and Henry Morton Stanley's In Darkest Africa. Valuable books, these, precious books, and a great heritage. These are some of the more modern ones, some of the older ones, his letters, and one school textbook I had hand in producing. And when you go to Livingstone, the town of Livingstone, the city of Livingstone, Zambia, I counted 8 monuments to Livingstone. Just in that one town. And they're still building new ones. This is a Livingstone High School. This is at the Livingstone Museum, all in Zambia, in Livingstone. This was built and erected in 2005 to mark the 150th anniversary of the mapping and naming of Victoria Falls on the Zambian side. This was erected in 2011. And this was this is at the Victoria at the Livingstone Airport, International Airport, of Livingstone and his two faithful followers. And again, with the Bible in one hand. You can go to places like this in Malawi, and they've walled off a historic tree because at one point David Livingstone rested under this tree. There was all kinds of memorials. We got the Livingstone 200 going, and we sent off our outreachers going throughout these areas and distributed 3.5 tons of Bibles and gospel booklets and audiovisual materials throughout the 12 countries where Livingstone worked. Although, as I said, while we did this over 7 months, we did cheat, we did drive. And when people in our mission have complained about the bad roads, I've told them, David Livingstone walked where we drive. So we don't have anything to complain about when you talk about bad roads. This is the Livingstone 200 conference we organized in November 2013. And what a privilege to be there, camped out on the banks of the Zambezi River. And we had Zambian National TV. We got to the Livingston Teacher Training College, Zambian National TV and local TV and Christian TV and the mayor's office. And boy, was it a sweltering hot day. And I remember people coming and asking me, can I stand over you holding an umbrella? And I said, I don't think that would be honoring to David Livingston. He didn't have someone holding an umbrella over him. And others said, don't you want to take off your jacket? And I said, I don't think I could do that because Livingston didn't take off his jacket while he walked across Africa. It's just one service. We've got to maintain standards here. St. Andrew's Church of England, which is in Livingston, had morning service. A whole lot of our audios and videos are available from that big event. Here's his signature, and those are his boots. I often complain about why do our boots fall apart after a couple of hikes? You know, Livingston could walk across Africa, and okay, he needed to do some repairs on the way, but they made boots better back then, didn't they? And with all of our technology, you think, why can't they make boots to last? Still, anyway, any questions, comments on Livingston and his legacy? Yes. Well, he had an extraordinary amount of top-class things, yes. They didn't have the same kind of rucksacks that we use today because the rucksacks, even the term rucksack is a German term that comes from the Alpine ones that the Swiss and Austrians would have used in the Alps. And the rucksacks only really got popular in Europe late 1800s. So he was before rucksacks were invented or came along. So basically, he would have had sling bag. As you can see, there's sometimes a sling bag here and a sling bag there, but a nice fitting backpack rucksack. They didn't have that technology at the time.
But how did he have enough space to carry all his scientific?
Well, that's why he had porters helping with carrying a whole lot of these things too. Yes, of course. Yes, you think of what we need, and we need trailers and buckies and roof racks. And nice store of ammunition. Well, bear in mind, he was coming out here before they had cartridges. So he had powder and shot. Even a six-barreled revolver, all of it was powder and shot. Before, by his third missionary journey, he would have had cartridges. But in fact, he used them at one of the most hideous attacks when the Arabs were raiding people near Ujiji, and he documented that, and he took the Union Jack and planted it in the ground. He had his revolver in one hand, he had a sword in the other, and he called to people to rally under the British flag for protection, and protected the people in this village who were being attacked, and told them, if you want war with Britain, then defy this, but I have the authority of Queen Victoria as a consul at large in Africa, and he declared this village to be under the protection of Queen Victoria and the British flag. And so, brave man. Again, most people don't know he had a very nice sword too, and that was amongst some of his effects that were brought back, along with his sextant and his binoculars and all the different everything from thermometers onwards. And he had so much scientific equipment with him because he really was a very scientifically orientated man. Yes.
It is sad that after him fighting the Arabs and slave trade for so long, other people under the name of Christianity come after him and still do slavery.
Certainly not from Britain. The British people were very, very strongly anti-slavery from the time of William Wilberforce. Since William Wilberforce, who would have been his elders, because Wilberforce had died before Livingston made it to the field. So the British people had been moved from being involved in the slave trade 200 years before into being the most vigorous anti-slavery nation on earth. It was the number one foreign policy concern in the 19th century, and the Royal Navy's highest priority was fighting the slave trade. So David Livingston had no fear that any British people would follow him and want to do slavery, but there were Arabs, of course, who were already in the field when he was going to many of these places. That's why he is saying, why is it that the slave trader can go there? Can the love of Christ not compel a missionary to go where the slave trader can reach? If they can reach it, why can't we? So, no, I don't think he in any way needed to fear that. The only Europeans involved in the slave trade at that time would have been Portugal. And he ate into Portuguese territory by encouraging the British to declare protectorate over Nyasaland, which was a major slave trading area. In fact, I think, Daniel, you've got a relative who was a missionary in Malawi and Nyasaland, where haven't you even got a picture there of where they actually had the old cannon to fight the slave traders on Lake Nyasa to Lake Malawi to stop the slave? We've seen that there.
I didn't know that one.
Okay, well, that was from someone else then. But you had a relative in the past who was involved in missions?
Yeah, great-grandfather was doing missions up in Lake Malawi, up and down.
So the British actually had gunboats on the Lake Nyasa, Lake Malawi, to protect from slave raiders coming and doing raids from Malawi, from Mozambique, across into Malawi. And many of the missionaries were right in the forefront of fighting the slave trade. So, for example, one of these people who David Livingston recruited, a Bishop Mackenzie. Now, he's quite a character. Bishop Mackenzie. his newsletters are full of battles with the slave traders. I mean, he seemed to have spent as much time fighting slave traders as preaching the gospel. And he went into Malawi immediately after Livingston. Livingston was still alive, but he had moved now further north into Tanzania as a result of Livingston's second missionary journey and teaching. And so there he was fighting the slave traders in Malawi. Bishop Mackenzie died there of malaria, but in the middle of all kinds of battles. So there were some missionaries took it very seriously. They went to the field with the goal of crushing the slave trade, setting the captives free. And, of course, tremendous pressure was brought to bear on Portugal to stop the slave trade as a result of what he had mentioned. They were not doing much slave raids, but the Arabs were doing everything. And, of course, that came to skiddy halts with Livingston and Henry Morton Stanley. When Henry Morton Stanley brought out the news from Livingston's third missionary journey, the British government felt humiliated that an American had given him the aid that they had failed to. And therefore, they launched what Livingston's dying prayer was, a campaign to close down the slave market of Zanzibar, which was the worst. And they gave an ultimatum, shelled the Sultan's palace, and within the hour, the white flag came up, shortest war in history, according to the Guinness Book of Records, and set the captives free in Zanzibar. And that was done reluctantly, because the British government wanted a good relationship with Portugal for some reason. But it was the writings of Livingston and Henry Morton Stanley that forced them to change their policies, until Portugal was so ashamed they had to stop as well. Oh, overwhelmingly animist. The Muslims that were there didn't live in the interior. They were just coming in on slave raids.
Because we learned in primary school that the first light-skinned people reaching out in Africa were Muslims because of the slave trade, and a lot of chiefs turned Muslims and stuff like that. So there was also a lot of Muslims. Mm. And then when Christians came, or like the missionaries, the fact that they were fighting the slave trade made a lot of Africans convert to Christianity.
I'm sure that's true. I would imagine so, because yes, you'd think for centuries they've had slave trades of different sorts, both internal slave trades and slave trades between different tribes, and then you had the Islamic slave trade, which was the worst and the biggest of all. So the Christians coming and stopping slavery and speaking against it would have been revolutionary. Yes. Any other observations, comments, Lemisa?
David Livingston ever advocate for the crown to arm the natives, or teach them how to have to fight with the arms against?
He had no problem with that too, and in fact that's one of the reasons why he was very disliked by the Boers, sadly, of the Transvaal, because he was involved in arming and advocating the arming of many of the local people to protect themselves against slave trades, and it was perceived as irresponsible by the Boers at that time that he would be advocating for modern weapons, muskets, to be provided to the local tribes. So, yes, he was way ahead of his time on that one. Any other comments? Yes?
Would donkeys, for example, be immune to?
I think donkeys would die just as easily from I presume not as easily as a thoroughbred horse, but surely a donkey is going to suffer from tsetse fly. I suppose a cow, but even a cattle could be killed by tsetse fly a lot. In fact, many cattle died of tsetse fly. If you have followed the Jock of the Bushveld stories, remember when they were going on these trades between the Transvaal and Mozambique, sometimes the whole oxen train would be killed by tsetse fly on the way, and they'd end up absolutely transportless. So it was a real, genuine problem. But as a result, we've got the Kruger National Park and that whole area that was tsetse fly ridden. So even something that we're not that happy with, I've been bitten by tsetse fly as well, on my knee, right through my jeans at that time. Unbelievable. So, you know, they've got a lance. They can go through pretty thick fabric, and it was so sore. It didn't matter how much time I put cortisone cream on multiple times a day, 8 times a day, and it still ached. So I think tsetse fly bite must be one of the most virulent bites I've come across, with the exception of scorpion.
They never use elephants like they do in India and Africa.
I don't know if anyone could ever tame an African elephant to be able to. You know, really, I think you've got to import Indian elephants for it. Yeah. Indian elephants seem to be willing to carry heavy loads, but I think an African elephant's going to think you've got to be kidding. He would trample, and he's got these tusks for good reason, so good luck on anyone wanting to try that. Yes?
Is it because of tsetse flies that horses and stuff like that are not in the middle of Africa, like around the equator?
For sure. I would say tsetse fly would be a very major reason for that. Yes? I'm sorry?
And African horse sickness.
African horse sickness. Okay, well, you'd know more about that than I would. You want to tell us more?
It's the occurs in tropical areas, also from fly bites, but it's not tsetse fly.
Well, we've got a lot of funny flies. I remember in Rhodesia we had the putsy fly. The putsy fly. Now, seriously, growing up in Rhodesia, and I'm sure it's true for Malawi as well, but you had to iron everything. Your sheets, your underwear, in especially, because the putsy fly would lay their larva in warm fabric on washing lines, warm, damp. And then, you know, you can imagine you're putting on your clothes, especially your underwear or sheets or pillowcases, and then these things start burrowing in and planting, and you get horrible, horrible sores from these putsy fly. So the only way to kill them was ironing your clothes, ironing the sheets, ironing everything thoroughly, every corner. You couldn't leave anything out. You couldn't do a slapdash ironing that most people do today. And so, I mean, I've even got that idea today. Can't iron without getting every single corner completely. It's just built into... My wife's smiling at me like, when have I ironed? Well, I don't have to at home when I'm in Pines, but on the road I've had to do ironing. And when I do, I still find myself in a frame of mind. And in fact, it's essential. So even though they're making fabric these days that doesn't need ironing, you would still iron it if you were in those areas. So, any other comments?
I just wanted to ask, according to the biblical mandate, where would be the balance of involving your family in missions?
There's got to be a balance, but of course, bear in mind, in the 19th century, they didn't have the modern travel we have. I mean, Livingston came out in a wooden sail ship. It took 3 months by sea to get from England to Cape Town. It took 4 months by foot to get from Delgo Bay up to Kuruman in northern Transvaal, northern Cape. So that's 7 months to reach a field. So when you think of that, no wonder they were separated from the family for such long times. We don't need to go to such extremes now. So we shouldn't, in this age of focus on the family, be judging people of a previous generation by the standards of what they did. We can do a lot better than that now. And of course, we've got medicines that they didn't have available then either, so that missionaries aren't going to certain death in the field, whereas there weren't a past. And to take your family into many of these fields would have been highly irresponsible at that time. But now, many of these things are possible. I mean, right now, we've got Taryn and her child in Mozambique, in an area where you wouldn't have considered taking a pregnant woman back before you had all these, like quinine and so on. So while we could look at what Livingstone did and we say, this is shocking to be separate from your family for years, but we don't have to make those decisions now. But at that time, somebody had to make that sacrifice in order to extend the gospel in those areas because there was no alternative. There was no better transportation. There was no excellent medicine. So we shouldn't try and take what they did and project it onto our standards today, nor should we try and project back our standards of today and judge them harshly because they didn't have the same options we have. But yes, it's so important that we realize God first, family second, work third. The trouble is when it's missionary work, work and God often is a balance now. We know God comes first, but he expects us to put our family right up above our work. But it's still below the kingdom. So this balance. We don't want to be those kind of people who abandon and neglect their family and they spend all the energy helping other people's families and then neglect their own family and their own children. Now that's an extreme, which there was a generation or so of missionaries who did that. In fact, in the early part of the 20th century, many missionaries sent their children to boarding school. And the children didn't see their parents but a couple of weeks or maybe a couple of months a year at most. Sometimes not even that. And we don't have to do that these days. We've got homeschooling. We've got a whole lot of other options. But I fear that some bad decisions were made, especially in the 20th century when there were literally almost every missionary's child was being shipped off to a boarding school. And these children were often brutalized in these boarding schools. Many hated it. Many actually turned away from the faith because of the experience in the boarding schools. So we can learn from the past. It's not all good. There's a lot bad that we can learn too. Yes?
I just want to mention that in Congo, the quinine is apparently, it's considered very powerful, so they have to dilute it. Like, you can't just have a whole 100% quinine tablet. It's like diluted with other things in order to drink it. And unless you have like a very desperate case, then you have it like, you know these tubes where they pour it into your body?
Yeah, but IV drip.
They say it has a lot of side effects. The side effects are very powerful, so you
yes.
Have it all.
For example, in Born Free, George Adamson, when he had malaria, he overdosed on quinine, and it made him go absolutely crazy, wild. Yes, but even worse than that, you can start attacking the people around you. So it's very serious to overdose on quinine too. It's true. You've got to get the right... But again, Livingstone would have been testing on himself. He guinea-pigged on himself to see what worked. Quite extraordinary. Anything else before we close?
Just a question. Do you think that he died at such a young age? Do you think that is just the lifespan of the missionary or did God just say it's well done?
Well, you know, David Livingstone beat the odds. He died at age 60. That's not young for 19th century missionaries. He survived 26 years in the field. Reginald Heber, Bishop Reginald Heber, who wrote the hymn From Green's Icy Mountains, which you just sang, he died at age 42 in the field. You've got many missionaries who died within 2 years to 8 years of entering the field. So David Livingstone, dying at age 60, considering all the diseases and fevers and so on that he had in the field, that was not considered dying young back then.
Well, and especially considering the fact that his diet was probably not that great either.
No.
It would have been fairly limited.
Yes.
So 60 is good going, considering what all he was up against in the field.
He beat the odds, very much.